Naturally Speaking. Naturally
Speaking. Hi, and thanks for listening to the latest episode of the Naturally Speaking podcast. My name's James Grecian, and I'm joined here today with James Buckley.
Hello.
We're also joined with two postdocs in the department at the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine. We've got Sunny Townsend and Joe Halliday.
Hello.
Okay, so what would be really useful is to find a bit about what you both do, and then we'll go into a bit of detail about some of the research you've published fairly recently, and we'll hopefully go through that in a vaguely coherent way.
Vaguely
coherent way. But so first, I mean, Joe, do you want to tell us a bit about your, so what your role is here and your interests?
Okay. So I'm a postdoc here at the Institute, and I'm currently working on a project which is a field epidemiology project based in Tanzania, but with quite a few, involving quite a few members of the department here in Glasgow. And we're looking at the sort of epidemiology and burden of three bacterial zoonoses that people acquire through infections from livestock that they live with.
Okay.
In northern Tanzania. So the pathogens we look at are called brucellosis, leptospirosis and Q fever.
Nice.
And trip off the tongue. And despite the fact that we think they impose big burdens on livestock productivity and human health, we know alarmingly little about them and how to deal with them.
Okay, we'll come back to some of the terminology and stuff in a second, but I think before that we'll find a bit about what Sunny does. So do you want to tell us a bit about your broad research interests and your role in the department?
My role?
So
I work on a disease called rabies. I'm particularly interested in how we can design vaccination strategies better to improve the chances of eliminating this disease from countries or smaller regions. Yeah.
Places where it is endemic, I imagine.
Well, endemic and epidemics. So recently I've been working in Bali in Indonesia. Poor me, having to go to tropical field sites. so that was they had an outbreak in 2008, and we've been involved in sort of trying to help them come up with strategies to eliminate rabies.
Cool. So one of the things I might try and get us to start with is just kind of putting out an idea of what, when you're talking about epidemiology, we're talking about zoonotic pathogens, what some of these terms mean, because some of our listeners might not be too familiar with this idea of zoonotic pathogens.
By some of our listeners, we also mean ourselves.
I'm got a clue. So Joe, what's when you talk about zoonotic pathogens, what are we talking about?
Okay, so what we're talking about is pathogens and infections that people acquire through transmission from animals to people.
Okay, so they can occur both in animal kingdom and then they transfer and people can collect them just by being around them, by touching them or by eating them or...
Yeah, so there are a range of opportunities, and really what we're talking about here is multi-host pathogens where one of the hosts is humans.
Okay.
And we're interested because we're obviously mostly interested in human health and livestock productivity and that kind of thing, often most interested in the transmission from animal populations into human populations.
Okay, cool. I suppose that presents an even greater challenge for actually trying to understand them, given that they can be both in humans. Humans, I imagine monitoring diseases in humans is probably relatively, but compared to actually trying to also find out where things are in the natural populations of things, animals just like floating around everywhere, that must be even more challenging.
I think so. And there's sort of, it's sort of led, the recognition of that has led to a bit of a drive recently, which is called this sort of idea of what One Health is, where there's a recognition that to tackle these pathogens and this sort of group of diseases, you have to be integrating across disciplines and doing animal population research as well as human population research, as well as sort of ecosystem research and looking at how different populations are interacting with each other as well to try and understand the transmission processes.
So these really big, this One Health, is this an idea sort of presented by big international bodies, the World Health Organization, or is it Glasgow focused sort of idea? Is it quite a big, broad?
It's a pretty big, broad idea. It's been around for a while, but recently there's sort of, it's been taken up, I think, prompted by things like influenza outbreaks. There's been a bit more of a drive towards it, and there's, a few years ago, there was a tripartite concept note between WHO, OIE, and FAO. And there's a recognition OIE.
Yes, so the World Health Organization,
and the
Food
OIE,
and Agricultural Organization,
and the OIE, which is sort of the animal equivalent of the WHO.
Okay.
Okay, cool.
But it's something French, isn't it?
So yes.
I can't remember what it actually is.
So I'm not going to tell you what those letters actually stand for.
I can understand what you mean.
So, I mean, because these are, we're talking about some pretty nasty diseases then. I mean, things like Ebola, H5N1, rabies, these can cause massive problems to human health and occur in large animal reservoirs, if you like.
Yeah, and it's an enormous range of things as well. So as you know, as you say, there's sort of the high profile and quite alarming and scary pathogens that people hear about in news stories from Ebola, as you say. And then you also ranges all the way down to the endemic things that I work on that are less high profile, but actually probably have bigger impacts and burdens on the populations that live with them.
I suppose that's quite an important point, isn't it? That both your research interests are not in diseases that affect are problematic that we worry about most often in the developed world, you know, so influenza, and it's more the diseases that are that I think many of us would forget about and are actually endemic and really problematic in some of the developing parts of the world. And what are the main reasons why these diseases are so problematic in certain areas? Is it because people don't understand, you know, what they're doing, or is it just the lack of public health sort of awareness? Or
well, I think that rabies, for one, is a neglected disease. And that means neglected people suffer from it. Not that necessarily the disease is kind of... Well, it's neglected because people who suffer from it are sort of neglected. So the problem really is that they're not getting access to the treatment. And so for rabies, for example, the treatment exists. It's just expensive, and it's usually located quite far away from where the people actually suffer from rabies. Potentially having rabies can access it. So, so that's kind of one of the major barriers for rabies control.
Because, I mean, these diseases are, I mean, in these countries, they're frequently sort of under, it's very difficult to report, for people to report them, isn't it? And I think you probably imagine situations are a lot worse than you initially might expect. So, I don't know, do you find that sort of often it's very difficult to actually get information about to what extent these diseases are sort of problematic in these areas and how widespread they are.
Definitely, and as Sunny says, that sort of stems from the fact that all the pathogens that I work on are also in this group of diseases that are called neglected tropical diseases. And as Sunny says, it's really about the neglect of the populations. And zoonoses are pretty well represented within neglected tropical diseases because they tend to affect people who depend on animals and interact with animals. So people who keep livestock are very vulnerable to the impacts of these diseases being there in their lives every day and the impacts that they have on both their health and the health of their animals and the productivity of the animals which they depend upon for their livelihoods. But these are populations who are neglected for all sorts of development and economic reasons as well. And yeah, it is difficult to gather data on them. The three things that I work on specifically, there are lots of complications about them, and one of which is that they're really difficult to diagnose clinically. So people will present with a non-specific febrile illness. And in the absence of pretty much any good diagnostic tests, it's very difficult for a clinician faced with that I think you've got brucellosis and I'm going to treat you for it.
So it's one of the first challenges, actually identifying, so identifying which people are ill, but then identifying what pathogen is causing that illness is... It's not always apparent, and you can't always do it through symptoms, can you? It's not always possible.
As you
say,
if these areas are quite remote regions, then trying to fly like global experts in brucellosis into particular areas is obviously not really feasible. So public health screening at the root is really important in this case.
Yeah, and we work... the study that I work on currently has been prompted by a longer-term study that's been conducted in northern Tanzania looking at the febrile population that gets to hospital. And obviously, traditionally, malaria has been a big focus on in terms of like trying to diagnose what's causing these illnesses in people. But what this study that's been conducted over the past few years has done is work from a basis of implementing really gold standard diagnostic tests and looking at actually can we diagnose these cases rather than looking at them presumptively and diagnosing them as malaria. And they find that in the population that we're looking at, that they're looking at, 11 times more cases of fever, acute fever in hospitalised patients are caused by one of the three pathogens that we work on than are caused by malaria.
Because malaria is so prevalent, just everyone assumes that it's malaria.
Yeah, and in the area that we work in, malaria has declined considerably over the past decade or so, and it's certainly the case that malaria remains an enormous problem in many parts of the world. but there's such a pressure on clinicians not to miss malaria diagnoses, and they don't have any diagnostics with which to make any different kinds of assessments.
And I suppose
these people are being treated for malaria when they don't have malaria.
Okay. So I suppose the key thing is that to be able to control and prevent the spread of the disease, you need to know which one it is, because it's not the same strategies are not necessarily going to apply to everything. Is that correct, or are there sort of broad strategies that can be applied to that would be beneficial for all types of zoonotic diseases?
So I guess one of the things that we're trying to work on is thinking about this holistically and how to go around these kind of assessment processes holistically. So not say I'm going to fight for this one disease and I'm going to try and figure out how to do the diagnostics for that, but recognise that actually there are going to be lots of things going on here, and we need to think about things that are core and that can be useful to diagnosing or dealing with lots of these different diseases. Lots of the routes of transmission of human to animal to human infection are common. It's about close interaction with animals.
Yeah.
So what can we do to intervene either at those points of contact to reduce risks of transmission of several diseases potentially, or can we prevent the shedding of these infections from the animal populations so that they're not a potential threat to the humans?
Yeah, so I suppose in that case, you're looking at ways to basically monitor the risk and monitor what disease is present, but also look for situations in which transmission of any disease might be particularly prevalent. Is it really difficult to get people to report and get information from people who are getting infected or who are interacting with animals in close proximity? Is it very difficult to get this information? Or are people quite happy to provide information on when they've been ill and when their animals have been ill? Or is it quite difficult to get this information?
I think it's not... I'm not aware that there are big problems of people not giving information when they're asked for it. I don't think that's the problem that... a lot of these diseases are underreported, but I think there are other reasons for that. One is that often they're not asked. People aren't aware that they should be looking for them. They're difficult to diagnose, so it's difficult to write down an attributable cause for something, so it doesn't get counted. And the reporting issue, I think, sort of for disease reporting on the animal side particularly, a big reason that that doesn't happen, I think, is because nothing useful happens when you report anything. True. There aren't great infrastructures to respond to reports.
So it just feels like you're just telling people for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, and there isn't really a culture of doing that.
No, well, as you say, if it's really hard to diagnose differences in the causes of fever in people, it must be almost impossible to try and differentiate between different causes of illness in animals that can't tell you what's wrong with them.
I think so. I'm not a clinician of either kind, so I can't really help. <Yeah. laughs> But yeah, I think that's quite complicated.
So in most cases, it seems to be a case of just improve communication and make it easier to communicate, but also give the information about when people are ill, what they might be infected by, but also get the communication coming back the other way from the people who are actually able to maybe diagnose these things and say, well, you've got this is this disease, and in this case you might want to take these actions and take this medicine. Now, I suppose trying to get all that working together is a very difficult step, and I suppose.
Yeah, but as you say, it is a lot of it is about communication. So one thing is about clinician awareness, so that you can train clinicians about awareness of the things that they might be thinking about when they see a febrile patient, in our case anyway. But then you can also talk to the people who keep animals, and you can tell there are some pretty basic public health messages that you can talk to people about. Like some of the things that we work on are transmitted through consumption of, say, unpasteurised milk or undercooked meat, and those are pretty common risk factors, and you can talk to people about the risks that are associated with those kind of practices and try and understand why people do them and what the costs and benefits of different approaches of control would be for them.
It might be good to go into actually explore one particular case. So it might be good to look at, because a few number of people in our industry look at rabies and study that. So it might be useful to explore a bit about some of these issues in a more specific example. Thank you, James.
Well, I guess in something that's slightly easier to diagnose at a distance. You can walk in and see a load of animals with a fever and you might not be well go know what's going on, but if you walk into a village and a dog's screaming and shouting and got a frothing mouth, it might be slightly more obvious that you've got a case of rabies.
You've picked up a good point, and it is actually fairly easy to detect a rabid dog. Although saying that, there's some dogs will just kind of crawl under a rock and die, but it won't go out and bite lots of people and potentially transmit rabies and other dogs.
But I suppose in that case, it will emphasise any problems they have, you know, controlling and understanding the transmission of rabies will mean that it's even harder for diseases where you don't necessarily know.
Yeah.
You can't really easily see an infection. You can't really see determine what it is from just looking at the animal or person and say, oh, you've got that. So I suppose it's a, and imagine it's not as simple, you know, even though you can identify which animals have rabies, you still don't necessarily get the information. People don't necessarily give you the information.
Yeah,
and it's hard to get it, isn't it?
So I'm going to refer to one of Katie's studies and her work.
That's Katie Hampson.
Katie Hampson. So she does something called contact tracing, and she basically, when someone gets bitten and they come to a clinic, she'll kind of send out, or even herself, go and investigate what happened and find out all the dogs that were bitten by the dog that bit that person, all the other people that were bitten by that person, and try and sort of exhaustively follow that trail and get up a picture of the transmission of rabies.
So you almost have like build up a network of where the source has come from, if you like.
Yeah, so eventually hopefully you would get to a source. Maybe that was a dog that came from another village or something like that. But, you know, in trying to get a real picture of how rabies is potentially being transmitted. And not every person who gets bitten or every dog that gets bitten will get rabies. It's about a 50% chance. But identifying those dogs and those people, obviously, is really sort of useful for trying to control rabies and treat people. But really interestingly, it's get a picture of how rabies is transmitted and sort of interesting things like how many dogs does a rabid dog bite and things like that.
No, but I think that it's an interesting point to try and if you can get information about who bites who, that's quite critical for actually understanding the sort of the patterns of transmission, and understanding the patterns of transmission can therefore maybe help you identify. Is it useful for identifying areas where you can maybe try and focus your treatments and your preventative measures, and therefore try and sort of contain the disease? What sort of methods are used to try and control and prevent the spread of rabies? What can people do?
Okay, so the main way to attempt to control rabies is through the mass vaccination of dogs, and that involves kind of getting a dog and sticking a needle in it, which has its own complications. But the idea is don't like it. They often don't like it. And a lot of dogs in the places that we work are not very easy to just pick up. Someone often requires sort of catching them. So in Bali, for example, there are teams that have been trained up to go out and catch difficult dogs and vaccinate them.
Yeah. Because I suppose it's really going out and caging, you know, trapping dogs, almost not quite in the wild, but these are semi-feral animals that...
Well, yeah, so there's an interesting concept here. So what we understand is stray dogs, and what we've sort of grown up understanding what stray dogs are, you know, dogs that are not on a leash, effectively, or have an obvious owner nearby, are in most of the rest of the world, I mean, in most of the developing countries, anyway, that isn't really... It's not really the case. I mean, most dogs that you see on the street are owned. They're just
allowed to free roam,
like cats are in this country. Yeah. I mean, it's effectively the equivalent. But the Western world thinks that they're stray and they're not owned and they go and eat rubbish and that kind of thing. But they actually do get fed and they do have owners.
So the mass vaccination of dogs in an area does work, does it? It does prevent the spread of the disease. It's been in certain. I suppose it depends whether the air, how contained the area is. I mean, imagine if you've got a whole continent, then mass vaccination of every single dog on a continent is pretty challenging. But imagine if you've got a smaller, more contained location, like an island. The strategy depends quite a lot on where you are and what you're trying to. You know, what your aims are, I suppose.
Absolutely. No, that's a very good question. I mean, there's a very important concept which comes to this answer the question, which is herd immunity. So you don't necessarily need to vaccinate every single animal in order to protect the population.
Okay.
And this depends on how fast the disease spread, and particularly on a concept called the basic reproductive number.
We've come across this before.
Oh, have you? Okay. And
I think Sean was once explaining about it in the context of the film Contagion.
Oh, right.
And saying that someone... I can't remember the actress.
Kate Winslet
explains Arnott.
She does. There's a white picture of her like writing Arnott Valleys on a whiteboard, which I use in my presentation sometimes.
Hollywood works.
Yeah, totally.
But you can of course tell us an explanation if you want to. What do you mean by that? Is that
okay? So like we were talking about the contact rating. So it's basically the number of infections caused by a case. So if I had rabies and I bit you all here and I transmitted it to two of you, then the R naught for me would be 2. And if you scale that to a population, you take an average.
Yeah. If we then left and started biting other people,
spread it around the Graham Cuddle.
You might be a super spreader and just cover the whole campus.
Some people like to bite more than others, I suppose.
Get into football.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no footballers in this room.
Yeah, exactly.
So the point is, for rabies, it's actually really low. It's 1.2. So that's on average, a dog will bite and infect 1.2 other dogs. So it's only just above one. So it only actually reproduce. You know, if it was one, it would be reproducing itself. You know, and you can imagine like a birth.
Base rate,
yeah, exactly, like a constant population. But actually, so it increases slightly. But you just need to vaccinate enough to reduce that number below one, and that's the idea of control. I mean, like disease control. That's the basis of a lot of disease control, and we do that through dog vaccination. For slightly more complicated reason, we need to vaccinate 70% of the dog population.
I guess that's because if you've got a reservoir population in a certain area, you can vaccinate that, but depending on immigration and migration movements in between populations, if you vaccinate one population but then 100 dogs come over the hill from the next village and reduce the immunity of the population.
Yeah, and there's births and deaths and stuff going on, so you have to take that into account. But once you've taken that into account, if you vaccinate 70% of the dogs in a year, this is a debatable amount of time, but you know, the idea is you vaccinate 70% of the dogs over in an area, and then that will keep them at an R0 of below one, the disease at an R0 of below one, for until you do the next vaccination campaign, which is meant to be in the following sort of year sort of thing.
Is it possible to eradicate the disease, or is it possible just to keep it at a very low level?
No, it's possible to eradicate. So just push it below one. But it keeps it below one as long as you maintain that herd immunity. It can't spread. It's not technically true. It can spread, but it can't increase.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's on a downward trajectory.
Okay. So I suppose the key thing is also, though, it is going back to what we're talking about with Joe, is the surveillance of it. So you need to make sure that you're good methods for surveillance, because if you don't, I suppose, A, you want to know, you know, how prevalent it is in a population. I suppose that's quite important for... Does that modify the type of strategy you might use to control it, or...?
Absolutely. Well, okay, so the recommendation we've looked at lots of different strategies, and the two kind of key big ones are sort of a proactive strategy and a reactive strategy. And the proactive is kind of blanket vaccination. You just cover the whole area. So like an island like Bali, you just, that 70% of all, every village, every dog, all the dogs in every village kind of thing. That's the plan. Versus a kind of, we know there's a case here, and we go and we just vaccinate that village. The work that I do suggests that you need blanket vaccination because we don't have high enough levels of detection to be able to know that we've missed an area that's had a case, but we haven't detected that case, and so you vaccinate somewhere else and it just, rabies still spreads in another part of the island.
So in terms of trying to understand all these methods, I mean, you used a lot of ecological modelling to try and bring to, do you sort of collect the data and then were you involved in just sort of the putting the data and parameters in and using the data to estimate various parameters, which you can then put into a model and then see what happens when you implement various sort of strategies.
You've described it almost perfectly. No, it was really great. Yeah, you understand the concept. I mean, we use data from Katie because she's collected this amazing contact tracing data, and that really is what's put into the model. But we put it on to space, or put it on a, like on a map of Bali, basically, and we and then we try the strategies so we can add spatial variation and whether you had good vaccination over here or you did a reactive campaign, and then look at how that affects your prospects for elimination.
And in that, one of the things that we were talking about earlier that kind of, I guess, comes into play is this idea of the probability of detection. So it seemed quite important in that paper that the earlier that you detect this outbreak, the more likely it is that you'll be able to react to it and trying to kind of kibosh it to stop it from spreading too far.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, no, you've got rabies to start with, so it's kind of like it might take, if you've got like only a 1% chance of detecting rabies, for example, then it could take like years almost before the numbers grow to an amount that you actually detect it. And then you've got that response lag. Usually it's months, potentially also years. And then within that time, you know, it's an exponentially increasing, you know, burden. And then eventually when you actually start implementing control, you've got a really bad situation on your hands. Yeah. So it was, again, in Bali, it was quite a slow, everything was quite slow to respond. And we think they had about 7,000 rabies case of dogs on the island. And by the time they actually started implementing any kind of mass vaccination campaign.
And I guess the earlier you get it, in theory, potentially the cheaper the cost of actually rectifying the problem. If you're going to try and kill 7,000 dogs and then vaccinate the rest of the population, it's quite expensive. Whereas if you can get that first, you know, 10, 20, 100 cases, it's, the cost overall would be much less.
Yeah, the costs are down and the time that you're going to eliminate it is down, and chance of eliminating it and not it turning into an endemic, you know, disease.
I suppose this is part of what Joe was, you know, saying earlier, isn't it? The sort of globe, you know, sort of having a system in place which will be able to carefully monitor a range of things. So if you set up for every disease, you had to set up a separate system for monitoring and you know, keeping an eye on it, then it would be, I imagine, virtually impossible, isn't it, to try and get, because I'm not familiar with this, but I imagine that, you know, we've talked about only a small subset that are possible zoonotic diseases.
Yeah, and one of the things we talked about a bit in the paper that we referred to earlier on, we've thought about the sort of the ways that you can think about what you need in terms of surveillance for outbreaks of new infectious diseases, and how you can think about that and reconcile them with what you also need for surveillance of endemic diseases. Because there's quite a lot of interest at the moment in sort of global surveillance of outbreaks of things, and if you think about how you're going to set up a system for a developing country to tell you when this new thing arrives, what are you going to train those people to do, and what are they going to do whilst they're waiting for whatever that is to happen? Yeah. And how will you know if that system works whilst you wait? And what we argue is that actually the thing that you should do is sort of have a group of people who are doing the surveillance for the things that you already have and the problems that you already have, because they're also the people who are going to notice when something weird happens and tell you about an outbreak or something odd. And that there are these core things, which is really about people noticing when infectious disease are occurring and affecting populations, and also knowing who to talk to about that and where they can go to, and the links that you need between sort of the animal sector and the human sector are only built up by people working together over time. So if people have worked together for a long time to try and control an endemic disease, when something new happens, they'll know who to talk to. So we kind of argue this case. I mean, it'll take a long time for us to figure out if this works in practice, and it's not a trivial undertaking, but we kind of think it makes sense, and that also a system is more likely to be sustainable if you get results through doing the surveillance and control of the endemic diseases that you have, rather than not knowing what's going to happen when something new happens.
So I suppose,
just waiting.
I suppose that's focusing on a few diseases and trying to understand, and different diseases as well, so... Because rabies is an RNA virus, is it? A virus of...
Oh, we're getting into the technical...
I can't remember. But
it is, yes.
And also looking at things like bacterial zoonotic disease, I imagine there's, you know, trying to get a good idea of all the different possible types of pathogens. And we haven't even mentioned, I imagine, some of the other diseases that can be caused by, I'd imagine, nematodes and tapeworm, all these sort of things, which... So there's a lot of disease out there, and it's a... I imagine it's very difficult to try and monitor everything, but it sounds at least like you're both giving it a good go to try and trying to try and solve some of the problems at least, which is...
We should say that we'll put links to both the papers on the blog, so if anyone's been listening and they're kind of interested in reading a little bit more about that, we can you can download the papers through the links that we'll get. And with that, I think we'll bring this week's podcast to a close. Finally saying thanks again to Sunny and to Joe for talking to us about this really, really interesting topic. And hopefully tune in again next time and listen to Naturally Speaking.
And hopefully it won't be as long between episodes.
No. Oh, no, thank you. Thanks for listening to the Naturally Speaking podcast. If you've got any ideas for future shows or want to get involved, then please contact us. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is naturallyspeakingpodcast@gmail.com. Naturally Speaking is a podcast from the Institute of Biodiversity, Animal Health and Comparative Medicine at the University of Glasgow. For more information, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at the NS Podcast. And you can download future episodes and find more information at our blog at naturallyspeakingpodcast.wordpress.com.